Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Book 2, Chapter 1 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 1. A Tartar Camp. At a day's march from Kolyvan, several versts beyond the town of Diachinks, stretches a wide plain, planted here and there with great trees, principally pines and cedars. This part of the steppe is usually occupied during the warm season by Siberian shepherds and their numerous flocks, but now it might have been searched in vain for one of its nomad inhabitants. Not that the plain was deserted, it presented a most animated appearance. There stood the Tartar tents. There Feofar Khan, the terrible emir of Bokhara, was encamped, and there on the following day, the 7th of August, were brought the prisoners taken at Kolyvan after the annihilation of the Russian force, which had vainly attempted to oppose the progress of the invaders. Of the 2,000 men who had engaged the two columns of the enemy, the bases of which rested on Tomsk and Omsk, only a few hundred remained. Thus events were going badly, and the imperial government appeared to have lost its power beyond the frontiers of the Ural, for a time at least, for the Russians could not fail eventually to defeat the savage hordes of the invaders. But in the meantime the invasion had reached the center of Siberia, and it was spreading through the revolted country both to the eastern and the western provinces. If the troops of the Amur and the province of Takutsk did not arrive in time to occupy it, Irkutsk, the capital of Asiatic Russia, being insufficiently garrisoned, would fall into the hands of the Tartars, and the Grand Duke, brother of the Emperor, would be sacrificed to the vengeance of Ivan Ogareff. What had become of Michael Strogoff? Had he broken down under the weight of so many trials? Did he consider himself conquered by the series of disasters which, since the adventure of Ichim, had increased in magnitude? Did he think his cause lost, that his mission had failed, that his orders could no longer be obeyed? Michael was one of those men who never give in while life exists. He was yet alive, he still had the imperial letter safe, his disguise had been undiscovered. He was included amongst the numerous prisoners whom the Tartars were dragging with them like cattle, but by approaching Tomsk he was at the same time drawing nearer to Irkutsk. Besides, he was still in front of Ivan Ogareff. "I will get there," he repeated to himself. Since the affair of Kolyvan, all the powers of his mind were concentrated on one object, to become free. How should he escape from the Emir's soldiers? Feofar's camp presented a magnificent spectacle. Numberless tents of skin, felt, or silk glistened in the rays of the sun. The lofty plumes which surmounted their conical tops waved amidst banners, flags, and pennons of every color. The richest of these tents belonged to the Saids and the Khojas, who are the principal personages of the Khanate. A special pavilion, ornamented with a horse's tail issuing from a sheaf of red and white sticks artistically interlaced, indicated the high rank of these Tartar chiefs. Then in the distance rose several thousand of the Turkoman tents called Karioi, which had been carried on the backs of camels. The camp contained at least 150,000 soldiers, as many foot as horse soldiers, collected under the name of Alamanes. Amongst them, and as the principal types of Turkestan, would have been directly remarked the Tajiks, from their regular features, white skin, tall forms, and black eyes and hair, They formed the bulk of the Tartar army, and of them the Khanates of Kokand and Kandouj had furnished a contingent nearly equal to that of Bokhara. With the Tajiks were mingled specimens of different races who either reside in Turkestan or whose native countries border on it. There were Uzbeks, red-bearded, small in stature, similar to those who had pursued Michael. Here were Kyrgyz, with flat faces like the Kalmucks, dressed in coats of mail. Some carried the lance, bows, and arrows of Asiatic manufacture, some the saber, a matchlock gun, and the chakane, a little short-handled axe, the wounds from which invariably prove fatal. There were Mongols, of middle height, with black hair plaited into pigtails, which hung down their back, round faces, swarthy complexions, lively deep-set eyes, scanty beards, dressed in blue nankeen trimmed with black plush, sword belts of leather with silver buckles, coats gaily braided, and silk caps edged with fur and three ribbons fluttering behind. Brown-skinned Afghans, too, might have been seen, Arabs having the primitive type of the beautiful Semitic races, and Turkomans, with eyes which looked as if they had lost the pupil, all enrolled under the Emir's flag, the flag of incendiaries and devastators. Among these free soldiers were a certain number of slave soldiers, principally Persians, commanded by officers of the same nation, and they were certainly not the least esteemed of Feofar Khan's army. If to this list are added the Jews, who acted as servants, their robes confined with a cord, and wearing on their heads instead of the turban which is forbidden them, little caps of dark cloth, if with these groups are mingled some hundreds of Kalenders, a sort of religious mendicants, clothed in rags, covered by leopard skin, some idea may be formed of the enormous agglomerations of different tribes included under the general denomination of the Tartar army. Nothing could be more romantic than this picture, in delineating which the most skillful artist would have exhausted all the colors of his palette. Feofar's tent overlooked the others, draped in large folds of a brilliant silk looped with golden cords and tassels, surmounted by tall plumes which waved in the wind like fans. It occupied the center of a wide clearing, sheltered by a grove of magnificent birch and pine trees. Before this tent, on a japanned table inlaid with precious stones, was placed the sacred book of the Koran, its pages being of thin gold leaf delicately engraved. Above floated the Tartar flag, quartered with the Emir's arms. In a semicircle round the clearing stood the tents of the great functionaries of Bokhara. There resided the chief of the stables, who has the right to follow the Emir on horseback even into the court of his palace, the Grand Falconer, the Hoshbegui, bearer of the royal seal, the Topshibashi, Grand Master of the Artillery, the Khoja, Chief of the Council, who receives the Prince's kiss, and may present himself before him with his girdle untied, the Sheikh ul-Islam, Chief of the Ulimas, representing the priests, the Qazi Askev, who, in the Emir's absence, settles all disputes raised among the soldiers, and lastly, the Chief of the Astrologers, whose great business is to consult the stars every time the Khan thinks of changing his quarters. When the prisoners were brought into the camp, the Emir was in his tent. He did not show himself. This was fortunate, no doubt. A sign, a word from him, might have been the signal for some bloody execution. But he entrenched himself in that isolation which constitutes in part the majesty of Eastern kings. He who does not show himself is admired, and above all, feared. As to the prisoners, they were to be penned up in some enclosure, where, ill-treated, poorly fed, and exposed to all the inclemencies of the weather, they would await Feofar's pleasure. The most docile and patient of them all was undoubtedly Michael Strogoff. He allowed himself to be led, for they were leading him where he wished to go, and under conditions of safety which free he could not have found on the road from Kolyvan to Tomsk. To escape before reaching that town was to risk again falling into the hands of the scouts, who were scouring the steppe. The most eastern line occupied by the Tartar columns was not situated beyond the 85th meridian, which passes through Tomsk. This meridian once passed, Michael considered that he should be beyond the hostile zones, that he could traverse Jeniski without danger, and gain Krasnoyarsk before Feofar Khan had invaded the province. Once at Tomsk, he repeated to himself, to repress some feelings of impatience which he could not entirely master, in a few minutes I should be beyond the outposts, and 12 hours gained on Feofar, 12 hours on Ogareff, that surely would be enough to give me a start of them to Irkutsk. The thing that Michael dreaded more than everything else was the presence of Ivan Ogareff in the Tartar camp. Besides the danger of being recognized, he felt, by a sort of instinct, that this was the traitor whom it was especially necessary to precede. He understood, too, that the union of Ogareff's troops with those of Feofar would complete the invading army, and that the junction once effected, the army would march en masse on the capital of Eastern Siberia. All his apprehensions came from this quarter, and he dreaded every instant to hear some flourish of trumpets, announcing the arrival of the lieutenant of the Emir. To this was added the thought of his mother, of Nadia, the one a prisoner at Omsk, the other dragged on board the Irtysh boats, and no doubt a captive, as Marfa Strogoff was. He could do nothing for them. Should he ever see them again? At this question, to which he dared not reply, his heart sank very low. At the same time with Michael Strogoff and so many other prisoners, Harry Blount and Alcide Jolivet had also been taken to the Tartar camp. Their former traveling companion, captured like them at the telegraph office, knew that they were penned up with him in the enclosure, guarded by numerous sentinels, but he did not wish to accost them. It mattered little to him, at this time especially, what they might think of him since the affair at Ichim. Besides, he desired to be alone, that he might act alone if necessary. He therefore held himself aloof from his former acquaintances. From the moment that Harry Blount had fallen by his side, Jolivet had not ceased his attentions to him. During the journey from Kolyvan to the camp, that is to say, for several hours, Blount, by leaning on his companion's arm, had been enabled to follow the rest of the prisoners. He tried to make known that he was a British subject, but it had no effect on the barbarians, who only replied by prods with a lance or a sword. The correspondent of the Daily Telegraph was, therefore, obliged to submit to the common lot, resolving to protest later, and obtain satisfaction for such treatment. But the journey was not the less disagreeable to him, for his wound caused him much pain, and without Alcide Jolivet's assistance he might never have reached the camp. Jolivet, whose practical philosophy never abandoned him, had physically and morally strengthened his companion by every means in his power. His first care, when they found themselves definitely established in the enclosure, was to examine Blount's wound. Having managed carefully to draw off his coat, he found that the shoulder had been only grazed by the shot. "This is nothing," he said, "a mere scratch. After 2 or 3 dressings you will be all to rights." "But these dressings?" asked Blount. "I will make them for you myself." "Then you are something of a doctor?" "All Frenchmen are something of doctors." And on this affirmation Alcide, tearing his handkerchief, made lint of one piece, bandages of the other, took some water from a well dug in the middle of the enclosure, bathed the wound, and skillfully placed the wet rag on Harry Blount's shoulder. "I treat you with water," he said. "This liquid is the most efficacious sedative known for the treatment of wounds, and is the most employed now. Doctors have taken 6,000 years to discover that. Yes, 6,000 years in round numbers." "I thank you, Monsieur Jolivet," answered Harry, stretching himself on a bed of dry leaves, which his companion had arranged for him in the shade of a birch tree. "Bah, it's nothing. You would do as much for me."
"I am not quite so sure," said Blount candidly.
"Nonsense, stupid! All English are generous."
"Doubtless, but the French?"
"Well, the French, they are brutes if you like. But what redeems them is that they are French. Say nothing more about that, or rather say nothing more at all. Rest is absolutely necessary for you."
But Harry Blount had no wish to be silent. If the wound, in prudence, required rest, the correspondent of the Daily Telegraph was not a man to indulge himself.
"Monsieur Jolivet," he asked, "do you think that our last dispatches have been able to pass the Russian frontier?"
"Why not?" answered Alcide. "By this time you may be sure that my beloved cousin knows all about the affair at Kolyvan."
"How many copies does your cousin work off of her dispatches?" asked Blount, for the first time putting his question direct to his companion.
"Well," answered Alcide, laughing, "my cousin is a very discreet person, who does not like to be talked about, and who would be in despair if she troubled the sleep of which you are in need."
"I don't wish to sleep," replied the Englishman. "What will your cousin think of the affairs of Russia?"
"That they seem for the time in a bad way. But bah! The Muscovite government is powerful. It cannot be really uneasy at the invasion of barbarians."
"Too much ambition has lost the greatest empires," answered Blount, who was not exempt from a certain English jealousy with regard to Russian pretensions in Central Asia.
"Oh, do not let us talk politics," cried Jolivet. "It is forbidden by the faculty. Nothing can be worse for wounds in the shoulder, unless it was to put you to sleep."
"Let us then talk of what we ought to do," replied Blount. "Monsieur Jolivet, I have no intention at all of remaining a prisoner to these Tartars for an indefinite time."
"Nor I either, by Jove."
"We will escape on the first opportunity?"
"Yes, if there is no other way of regaining our liberty."
"Do you know of any other?" asked Blount, looking at his companion.
"Certainly. We are not belligerents. We are neutral, and we will claim our freedom."
"From that brute of a Feofar Khan?"
"No, he would not understand," answered Jolivet, "but from his lieutenant, Ivan Ogareff."
"He is a villain,
no doubt. But the villain is a Russian. He knows that it does not do to trifle with the rights of men, and he has no interest to retain us. On the contrary, but to ask a favor of that gentleman does not quite suit my taste."
"But that gentleman is not in the camp, or at least I have not seen him here," observed Blount.
"He will come. He will not fail to do that. He must join the Emir. Siberia is cut in two now, and very certainly Feofar's army is only waiting for him to advance on Irkutsk."
"And once free, what shall we do?"
"Once free, we will continue our campaign and follow the Tartars, until the time comes when we can make our way into the Russian camp. We must not give up the game. No, indeed, we have only just begun. You, friend, have already had the honor of being wounded in the service of the Daily Telegraph, whilst I have as yet suffered nothing in my cousin's service." "Well, well, good," murmured Alcide Jolivet. "There he is asleep. A few hours' sleep and a few cold water compresses are all that are required to set an Englishman on his legs again. These fellows are made of cast iron."
And whilst Harry Blount rested, Alcide watched near him, after having drawn out his notebook, which he loaded with notes, determined besides to share them with his companion, for the greater satisfaction of the readers of the Daily Telegraph. Events had united them one with the other. They were no longer jealous of each other. So then, the thing that Michael Strogoff dreaded above everything was the most lively desire of the two correspondents. Ivan Ogareff's arrival would evidently be of use to them. Blount and Jolivet's interest was, therefore, contrary to that of Michael. The latter well understood the situation, and it was one reason, added to many others, which prevented him from approaching his former traveling companions. He therefore managed so as not to be seen by them. 4 days passed thus without the state of things being in any wise altered. The prisoners heard no talk of the breaking up of the Tartar camp. They were strictly guarded. It would have been impossible for them to pass the cordon of foot and horse soldiers which watched them night and day. As to the food which was given them, it was barely sufficient. Twice in the 24 hours they were thrown a piece of the intestines of goats grilled on the coals, or a few bits of that cheese called krut, made of sour ewe's milk, and which, soaked in mare's milk, forms the Kirghiz dish, commonly called kumis. And this was all. It may be added that the weather had become detestable. There were considerable atmospheric commotions, bringing squalls mingled with rain. The unfortunate prisoners, destitute of shelter, had to bear all the inclemencies of the weather, nor was there the slightest alleviation to their misery. Several wounded women and children died, and the prisoners were themselves compelled to dig graves for the bodies of those whom their jailers would not even take the trouble to bury. During this trying period, Alcide Jolivet and Michael Strogoff worked hard, each in the portions of the enclosure in which they found themselves. healthy and vigorous, they suffered less than so many others, and could better endure the hardships to which they were exposed. By their advice and the assistance they rendered, they were of the greatest possible use to their suffering and despairing fellow captives. Was this state of things to last? Would Feofar Khan, satisfied with his first success, wait some time before marching on Irkutsk? Such, it was to be feared, would be the case. But it was not so. The event so much wished for by Jolivet and Blount, so much dreaded by Michael, occurred on the morning of the 12th of August. On that day the trumpets sounded, the drums beat, the cannon roared. A huge cloud of dust swept along the road from Kolyvan. Ivan Ogareff, followed by several thousand men, made his entry into the Tartar camp. End of Book 2, Chapter 1. Book 2, Chapter 2 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 2. Correspondence in Trouble. Ivan Ogareff was bringing up the main body of the army of the Emir. The cavalry and infantry now under him had formed part of the column which had taken Omsk. Ogareff, not having been able to reduce the high town, in which, it must be remembered, the governor and garrison had sought refuge, had decided to pass on, not wishing to delay operations which ought to lead to the conquest of eastern Siberia. He therefore left a garrison in Omsk, and, reinforcing himself en route with the conquerors of Kolyvan, joined Feofar's army. Ivan Ogareff's soldiers halted at the outposts of the camp. They received no orders to bivouac. Their chief's plan, doubtless, was not to halt there, but to press on and reach Tomsk in the shortest possible time, it being an important town, naturally intended to become the center of future operations. Besides his soldiers, Ogareff was bringing a convoy of Russian and Siberian prisoners, captured either at Omsk or Kolyvan. These unhappy creatures were not led to the enclosure, already too crowded, but were forced to remain at the outposts without shelter, almost without nourishment. What fate was Feofar Khan reserving for these unfortunates? Would he imprison them in Tomsk, or would some bloody execution, familiar to the Tartar chiefs, remove them when they were found too inconvenient? This was the secret of the capricious Emir. This army had not come from Omsk and Kolyvan without bringing in its train the usual crowd of beggars, freebooters, peddlers, and gypsies, which compose the rearguard of an army on the march. All these people lived on the country traversed, and left little of anything behind them. There was, therefore, a necessity for pushing forward, if only to secure provisions for the troops. The whole region between Ichim and the Obi, now completely devastated, no longer offered any resources. The Tartars left a desert behind them. Conspicuous among the gypsies who had hastened from the western provinces was the Tsigani troop, which had accompanied Michael Strogoff as far as Perm. Sangar was there. This fierce spy, the tool of Ivan Ogareff, had not deserted her master. Ogareff had travelled rapidly to Ichim, whilst Sangar and her band had proceeded to Omsk by the southern part of the province. It may be easily understood how useful this woman was to Ogareff. With her gypsy band she could penetrate anywhere. Ivan Ogareff was kept acquainted with all that was going on in the very heart of the invaded provinces. There were 100 eyes, 100 ears, open in his service. Besides, he paid liberally for this espionage, from which he derived so much advantage. Once Sangar, being implicated in a very serious affair, had been saved by the Russian officer. She never forgot what she owed him, and had devoted herself to his service, body and soul. When Ivan Ogareff entered on the path of treason, he saw at once how he might turn this woman to account. Whatever order he might give her, Sangar would execute it. An inexplicable instinct, more powerful still than that of gratitude, had urged her to make herself the slave of the traitor to whom she had been attached since the very beginning of his exile in Siberia. Confidant and accomplice, Sangar, without country, without family, had been delighted to put her vagabond life to the service of the invaders thrown by Ogareff on Siberia. To the wonderful cunning natural to her race she added a wild energy, which knew neither forgiveness nor pity. She was a savage worthy to share the wigwam of an Apache or the hut of an Andaman. Since her arrival at Omsk, where she had rejoined him with her Tsiganes, Sangarre had not again left Ogareff. The circumstance that Michael and Marfa Strogoff had met was known to her. She knew and shared Ogareff's fears concerning the journey of a courier of the Tsar. Having Marfa Strogoff in her power, she would have been the woman to torture her with all the refinement of a redskin in order to wrest her secret from her. But the hour had not yet come in which Ogareff wished the old Siberian to speak. Sangarre had to wait, and she waited, without losing sight of her whom she was watching, observing her slightest gestures, her slightest words, endeavoring to catch the word son escaping from her lips, but as yet always baffled by Marfa's taciturnity. At the first flourish of the trumpets, several officers of high rank, followed by a brilliant escort of Uzbek horsemen, moved to the front of the camp to receive Ivan Ogareff. Arrived in his presence, they paid him the greatest respect, and invited him to accompany them to Feofar Khan's tent. Imperturbable as usual, Ogareff replied coldly to the deference paid to him. He was plainly dressed, but from a sort of impudent bravado, he still wore the uniform of a Russian officer. As he was about to enter the camp, Sangarre, passing among the officers, approached and remained motionless before him.
"Nothing?" asked Ogareff.
"Nothing."
"Have patience.
Is the time approaching when you will force the old woman to speak?"
"It is approaching, Sangarre."
"When will the old woman speak?"
"When we reach Tomsk."
"And we shall be there?"
"In 3 days."
A strange gleam shot from Sangar's great black eyes, and she retired with a calm step. Ogareff pressed his spurs into his horse's flanks, and followed by his staff of Tartar officers, rode towards the Emir's tent. Feofar Khan was expecting his lieutenant. The council, composed of the bearer of the royal seal, the Khoja, and some high officers, had taken their places in the tent. Ivan Ogareff dismounted and entered. Feofar Khan was a man of 40, tall, rather pale, of a fierce countenance and evil eyes. A curly black beard flowed over his chest. With his war costume, coat of mail of gold and silver, cross-belt and scabbard glistening with precious stones, boots with golden spurs, helmet ornamented with an aigrette of brilliant diamonds, Feofar presented an aspect rather strange than imposing for a Tartar Sardana Palus, an undisputed sovereign, who directs at his pleasure the life and fortune of his subjects. When Ivan Ogareff appeared, the great dignitaries remained seated on their gold-embroidered cushions, but Feofar rose from a rich divan which occupied the back part of the tent, the ground being hidden under the thick velvet pile of a Bokharian carpet. The Emir approached Ogareff and gave him a kiss, the meaning of which he could not mistake. This kiss made the lieutenant chief of the council, and placed him temporarily above the Khoja. Then Feofar spoke.
"I have no need to question you," said he. "Speak, Ivan. You will find here ears very ready to listen to you."
"Takshir," answered Ogareff, "this is what I have to make known to you."
He spoke in the Tartar language, giving to his phrases the emphatic turn which distinguishes the languages of the Orientals.
"Takshir, this is not the time for unnecessary words. What I have done at the head of your troops, you know. The lines of the Ichim and the Irtish are now in our power, and the Turkoman horsemen can bathe their horses in the now Tartar waters. The Kyrgyz hordes rose at the voice of Feofar Khan. You can now push your troops towards the east, and where the sun rises, or towards the west where he sets."
"And if I march with the sun?" asked the Emir,
without his countenance betraying any of his thoughts.
"To march with the sun," answered Ogareff, "is to throw yourself towards Europe. It is to conquer rapidly the Siberian provinces of Tobolsk as far as the Ural Mountains."
"And if I go to meet this luminary of the heavens?"
"It is to subdue to the Tartar dominion with Irkutsk the richest countries of Central Asia."
"But the armies of the Sultan of St. Petersburg," said Feofar Khan,
designating the Emperor of Russia by this strange title.
"You have nothing to fear from them," replied Ivan Ogareff. "The invasion has been sudden, and before the Russian army can succor them, Irkutsk or Tobolsk will have fallen into your power. The Tsar's troops have been overwhelmed at Kolyvan, as they will be everywhere where yours meet them."
"And what advice does your devotion to the Tartar cause suggest?" added the Emir, after a few moments' silence.
"My advice," answered Ivan Ogareff quickly, "is to march to meet the sun. It is to give the grass of the eastern steppes to the Turkoman horses to consume. It is to take Irkutsk, the capital of the eastern provinces, and with it a hostage, the possession of whom is worth a whole country. In the place of the Tsar, the Grand Duke, his brother, must fall into your hands."
This was the great result aimed at by Ivan Ogareff. To listen to him, one would have taken him for one of the cruel descendants of Stephen Razin, the celebrated pirate who ravaged southern Russia in the 18th century. To seize the Grand Duke, murder him pitilessly, would fully satisfy his hatred. Besides, with the capture of Irkutsk, all eastern Siberia would pass to the Tartars.
"It shall be thus, Ivan," replied Feofar.
"What are your orders, Takshir?"
"Today our headquarters shall be removed to Tomsk."
Ogareff bowed, and followed by the Hosh Begui, he retired to execute the Emir's orders. As he was about to mount his horse, to return to the outposts, a tumult broke out at some distance in the part of the camp reserved for the prisoners. Shouts were heard, and two or three shots fired. Perhaps it was an attempt at revolt or escape, which must be summarily suppressed. Ivan Ogareff and the Hosh Begui walked forward, and almost immediately two men, whom the soldiers had not been able to keep back, appeared before them. The Hosh Begui, without more information, made a sign which was an order for death, and the heads of the two prisoners would have rolled on the ground, had not Ogareff uttered a few words which arrested the sword already raised aloft. The Russian had perceived that these prisoners were strangers, and he ordered them to be brought to him. They were Harry Blount and Alcide Jolivet. On Ogareff's arrival in the camp, they had demanded to be conducted to his presence. The soldiers had refused. In consequence, a struggle, an attempt at flight, shots fired which happily missed the two correspondents, but their execution would not have been long delayed if it had not been for the intervention of the Emir's lieutenant. The latter observed the prisoners for some moments, they being absolutely unknown to him. They had been present at that scene in the post-house at Ichim, in which Michael Strogoff had been struck by Ogareff, but the brutal traveller had paid no attention to the persons then collected in the common room. Blount and Jolivet, on the contrary, recognized him at once, and the latter said in a low voice,
"Hello, it seems that Colonel Ogareff and the rude personage of Ichim are one."
Then he added in his companion's ear,
"Explain our affair, Blount. You will do me a service. This Russian colonel in the midst of a Tartar camp disgusts me, and although, thanks to him, my head is still on my shoulders, my eyes would exhibit my feelings were I to attempt to look him in the face."
So saying, Alcide Jolivet assumed a look of complete and haughty indifference. Whether or not Ivan Ogareff perceived that the prisoner's attitude was insulting towards him, he did not let it appear.
"Who are you, gentlemen?" he asked in Russian, in a cold tone, but free from its usual rudeness.
"Two correspondents of English and French newspapers," replied Blount laconically.
"You have doubtless papers which will establish your identity."
"Here are letters which accredit us in Russia from the English and French Chancellor's office."
Ivan Ogareff took the letters which Blount held out, and read them attentively.
"You ask," said he, "authorization to follow our military operations in Siberia?"
"We ask to be free, that is all,"
answered the English correspondent dryly.
"You are so, gentlemen," answered Ogareff. "I am curious to read your articles in the Daily Telegraph."
"Sir," replied Blount, with the most imperturbable coolness, "it is sixpence a number, including postage."
And therefore he returned to his companion, who appeared to approve completely of his replies. Ivan Ogareff, without frowning, mounted his horse, and going to the head of his escort, soon disappeared in a cloud of dust.
Well, Jolivet, what do you think of Colonel Ivan Ogareff, General-in-Chief of the Tartar troops? Asked Blount.
I think, my dear friend, replied Alcide, smiling, that the Hushbagui made a very graceful gesture when he gave the order for our heads to be cut off.
Whatever was the motive which led Ogareff to act thus in regard to the two correspondents, they were free and could rove at their pleasure over the scene of war. Their intention was not to leave it. The sort of antipathy which formerly they had entertained for each other had given place to a sincere friendship. Circumstances having brought them together, they no longer thought of separating. The petty questions of rivalry were forever extinguished. Harry Blount could never forget what he owed his companion, who, on the other hand, never tried to remind him of it. This friendship, too, assisted the reporting operations, and was thus to the advantage of their readers.
"And now," asked Blount, "what shall we do with our liberty?"
"Take advantage of it, of course," replied Alcide, "and go quietly to Tomsk to see what is going on there.
Until the time, very near, I hope, when we may rejoin some Russian regiment."
"As you say, my dear Blount, it won't do to Tartarize ourselves too much. The best side is that of the most civilized army, and it is evident that the people of Central Asia will have everything to lose and absolutely nothing to gain from this invasion, while the Russians will soon repulse them. It is only a matter of time."
The arrival of Ivan Ogareff, which had given Jolivet and Blount their liberty, was to Michael Strogoff, on the contrary, a serious danger. Should chance bring the Tsar's courier into Ogareff's presence, the latter could not fail to recognize in him the traveler whom he had so brutally treated at the Ishim post-house, and although Michael had not replied to the insult as he would have done under any other circumstances, attention would be drawn to him, and at once the accomplishment of his plans would be rendered more difficult. This was the unpleasant side of the business. A favorable result of his arrival, however, was the order which was given to raise the camp that very day and remove the headquarters to Tomsk. This was the accomplishment of Michael's most fervent desire. His intention, as has been said, was to reach Tomsk concealed amongst the other prisoners, that is to say, without any risk of falling into the hands of the scouts who swarmed about the approaches to this important town. However, in consequence of the arrival of Ivan Ogareff, he questioned whether it would not be better to give up his first plan and attempt to escape during the journey. Michael would, no doubt, have kept to the latter plan had he not learned that Feofar Khan and Ogareff had already set out for the town with some thousands of horsemen.
"I will wait, then," said he to himself, "at least until some exceptional opportunity for escape occurs. The adverse chances are numerous on this side of Tomsk, while beyond I shall in a few hours have passed the most advanced Tartar posts to the east. Still 3 days of patience, and may God aid me."
It was indeed a journey of 3 days which the prisoners, under the guard of a numerous detachment of Tartars, were to make across the steppe. 150 versts lay between the camp and the town, an easy march for the Emir's soldiers, who wanted for nothing, but a wretched journey for these people, enfeebled by privations. More than one corpse would show the road they had traversed. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, on the 12th of August, under a hot sun and cloudless sky, that the Topchi Bashi gave the order to start. Alcide and Blount, having bought horses, had already taken the road to Tomsk, where events were to reunite the principal personages of this story. Amongst the prisoners brought by Ivan Ogareff to the Tartar camp was an old woman, whose taciturnity seemed to keep her apart from all those who shared her fate. Not a murmur issued from her lips. She was like a statue of grief. This woman was more strictly guarded than anyone else, and without her appearing to notice, was constantly watched by the Tsigani Sangar. Notwithstanding her age, she was compelled to follow the convoy of prisoners on foot, without any alleviation of her suffering. However, a kind providence had placed near her a courageous, kind-hearted being to comfort and assist her. Amongst her companions in misfortune, a young girl, remarkable for beauty and taciturnity, seemed to have given herself the task of watching over her. No words had been exchanged between the two captives, but the girl was always at the old woman's side when help was useful. At first, the mute assistance of the stranger was accepted with some mistrust. Gradually, however, The young girl's clear glance, her reserve, and the mysterious sympathy which draws together those who are in misfortune, thawed Marfa Strogoff's coldness. Nadia, for it was she, was thus able, without knowing it, to render to the mother those attentions which she had herself received from the son. Her instinctive kindness had doubly inspired her. In devoting herself to her service, Nadia secured to her youth and beauty the protection afforded by the age of the old prisoner. On the crowd of unhappy people, embittered by sufferings, this silent pair, one seeming to be the grandmother, the other the granddaughter, imposed a sort of respect. After being carried off by the Tartar scouts on the Irtysh, Nadia had been taken to Omsk. Kept prisoner in the town, she shared the fate of all those captured by Ivan Ogareff, and consequently that of Marfa Strogoff. If Nadia had been less energetic, she would have succumbed to this double blow. The interruption to her journey, the death of Michael, made her both desperate and excited. Divided, perhaps forever, from her father, after so many happy efforts had brought her near him, and to crown her grief, separated from the intrepid companion whom God seemed to have placed in her way to lead her. The image of Michael Strogoff, struck before her eyes with a lance and disappearing beneath the waters of the Irtysh, never left her thoughts. Could such a man have died thus? For whom was God reserving his miracles if this good man, whom a noble object was urging onwards, had been allowed to perish so miserably? Then anger would prevail over grief. The scene of the affront so strangely borne by her companion at the Ischim Relay returned to her memory. Her blood boiled at the recollection. "Who will avenge him who can no longer avenge himself?" she said. And in her heart she cried, "May it be I!" If before his death Michael had confided his secret to her, woman, aye, girl though she was, she might have been able to carry to a successful conclusion the interrupted task of that brother whom God had so soon taken from her. Absorbed in these thoughts, it can be understood how Nadia could remain insensible to the miseries even of her captivity. Thus chance had united her to Marfa Strogoff without her having the least suspicion of who she was. How could she imagine that this old woman, a prisoner like herself, was the mother of him whom she only knew as the merchant Nicholas Korpanoff? And, on the other hand, how could Marfa guess that a bond of gratitude connected this young stranger with her son? The thing that first struck Nadia in Marfa Strogoff was the similarity in the way in which each bore her hard fate. This stoicism of the old woman under the daily hardships, this contempt of bodily suffering, could only be caused by a moral grief equal to her own. So Nadia thought, and she was not mistaken. It was an instinctive sympathy for that part of her misery which Marfa did not show which first drew Nadia towards her. This way of bearing her sorrow went to the proud heart of the young girl. She did not offer her services, she gave them. Marfa had neither to refuse nor accept them. In the difficult parts of the journey, the girl was there to support her. When the provisions were given out, the old woman would not have moved, but Nadia shared her small portion with her, and thus this painful journey was performed. Thanks to her companion, Marfa was able to follow the soldiers who guarded the prisoners without being fastened to a saddle bow, as were many other unfortunate wretches, and thus dragged along this road of sorrow.
"May God reward you, my daughter, for what you have done for my old age," said Marfa Strogoff once, and for some time these were the only words exchanged between the two unfortunate beings. During these few days, which to them appeared like centuries, it would seem that the old woman and the girl would have been led to speak of their situation. But Marfa Strogoff, from a caution which may be easily understood, never spoke about herself except with the greatest brevity. She never made the smallest allusion to her son, nor to the unfortunate meeting. Nadia also, if not completely silent, spoke little. However, one day her heart overflowed, and she told all the events which had occurred from her departure from Vladimir to the death of Nicholas Korpanoff. All that her young companion told intensely interested the old Siberian.
"Nicholas Korpanoff," said she, "tell me again about this Nicholas. I know only one man, one alone, in whom such conduct would not have astonished me. Nicholas Korpanoff, was that really his name? Are you sure of it, my daughter?"
"Why should he have deceived me in this," replied Nadia, "when he deceived me in no other way?"
Moved, however, by a kind of presentiment, Marfa Strogoff put questions upon questions to Nadia.
"You told me he was fearless, my daughter. You have proved that he has been so?"
asked she.
"Yes, fearless indeed," replied Nadia.
"It was just what my son would have done," said Marfa to herself.
Then she resumed.
"Did you not say that nothing stopped him, nor astonished him? That he was so gentle in his strength that you had a sister as well as a brother in him? And he watched over you like a mother?"
"Yes, yes," said Nadia. "Brother, sister, mother, he has been all to me,
and defended you like a lion."
"A lion indeed," replied Nadia. "A lion, a hero."
My son," thought the old Siberian. "But you said, however, that he bore a terrible insult at that post-house in Ishim?"
"He did bear it," answered Nadia, looking down.
"He bore it?"
murmured Marfa, shuddering.
"Mother, mother," cried Nadia, "do not blame him. He had a secret of which God alone is as yet the judge."
"And,"
said Marfa, raising her head, and looking at Nadia as though she would read the depths of her heart,
"in that hour of humiliation, did you not despise this Nicholas Korpanoff?"
"I admired him without understanding him," replied the girl. "I never felt him more worthy of respect."
The old woman was silent for a minute.
"Was he tall?"
she asked.
"Very tall."
"And very handsome. Come, speak, my daughter."
"He was very handsome," replied Nadia, blushing.
"It was my son! I tell you, it was my son!"
exclaimed the old woman, embracing Nadia.
"Your son?" said Nadia, amazed. "Your son?"
"Come," said Marfa, "let us get to the bottom of this, my child. Your companion, your friend, your protector had a mother. Did he never speak to you of his mother?"
"Of his mother?" said Nadia. "He spoke to me of his mother as I spoke to him of my father. Often, always, he adored her."
"Nadia, Nadia, you have just told me about my own son," said the old woman,
and she added impetuously,
"Was he not going to see this mother, whom you say he loved, in Omsk?"
"No," answered Nadia, "no, he was not."
"Not?" cried Marfa. "You dare to tell me not?"
"I say so, but it remains to me to tell you that from motives which outweighed everything else, motives which I do not know, I understand that Nicholas Korpanoff had to traverse the country completely in secret. To him it was a question of life and death, and still more, a question of duty and honor."
"Duty indeed, imperious duty," said the old Siberian, "of those who sacrifice everything, even the joy of giving a kiss, perhaps the last, to his old mother. All that you do not know, Nadia, all that I did not know myself, I now know. You have made me understand everything. But the light which you have thrown on the mysteries of my heart, I cannot return on yours. Since my son has not told you his secret, I must keep it. Forgive me, Nadia, I can never repay what you have done for me."
"Mother, I ask you nothing," replied Nadia.
All was thus explained to the old Siberian, all, even the conduct of her son with regard to herself in the inn at Omsk. There was no doubt that the young girl's companion was Michael Strogoff, and that a secret mission in the invaded country obliged him to conceal his quality of the Tsar's courier.
"Ah, my brave boy," thought Marfa. "No, I will not betray you, and tortures shall not wrest from me the avowal that it was you that I saw at Omsk."
Marfa could, with a word, have paid Nadia for all her devotion to her. She could have told her that her companion, Nicholas Korpanoff, or rather Michael Strogoff, had not perished in the waters of the Irtysh, since it was some days after that incident that she had met him, that she had spoken to him. But she restrained herself, she was silent, and contented herself with saying,
"Hope, my child, misfortune will not overwhelm you. You will see your father again, I feel it, and perhaps he who gave you the name of sister is not dead. God cannot have allowed your brave companion to perish. Hope, my child, hope. Do as I do. The mourning which I wear is not yet for my son."
End of Book 2, Chapter 2. Book 2, Chapter 3 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 3, Blow for Blow. Such were now the relative situations of Marfa Strogoff and Nadia. All was understood by the old Siberian, and though the young girl was ignorant that her much-regretted companion still lived, she at least knew his relationship to her whom she had made her mother, and she thanked God for having given her the joy of taking the place of the son whom the prisoner had lost. But what neither of them could know was that Michael, having been captured at Kolyvan, was in the same convoy and was on his way to Tomsk with them. The prisoners brought by Ivan Ogareff had been added to those already kept by the Emir in the Tartar camp. These unfortunate people, consisting of Russians, Siberians, soldiers, and civilians, numbered some thousands, and formed a column which extended over several versts. Some among them, being considered dangerous, were handcuffed and fastened to a long chain. There were, too, women and children, many of the latter suspended to the pommels of the saddles, while the former were dragged mercilessly along the road on foot, or driven forward as if they were animals. The horsemen compelled them to maintain a certain order, and there were no laggards with the exception of those who fell, never to rise again. In consequence of this arrangement, Michael Strogoff, marching in the first ranks of those who had left the Tartar camp, that is to say, among the Kolyvan prisoners, was unable to mingle with the prisoners who had arrived after him from Omsk. He had, therefore, no suspicion that his mother and Nadia were present in the convoy, nor did they suppose that he was among those in front. This journey from the camp to Tomsk, performed under the lashes and spear-points of the soldiers, proved fatal to many, and terrible to all. The prisoners travelled across the steppe, over a road made still more dusty by the passage of the Emir and his vanguard. Orders had been given to march rapidly. The short halts were rare. The 100 miles under a burning sky seemed interminable, though they were performed as rapidly as possible. The country, which extends from the right of the Obi to the base of the spur detached from the Sayanok Mountains, is very sterile. Only a few stunted and burnt-up shrubs here and there break the monotony of the immense plain. There was no cultivation, for there was no water, and it was water that the prisoners, parched by their painful march, most needed. To find a stream, they must have diverged 50 versts eastward to the very foot of the mountains. There flows the Tom, a little affluent of the Obi, which passes near Tomsk before losing itself in one of the great northern arteries. There water would have been abundant, the steppe less arid, the heat less severe. But the strictest orders had been given to the commanders of the convoy to reach Tomsk by the shortest way, for the Emir was much afraid of being taken in the flank and cut off by some Russian column descending from the northern provinces. It is useless to dwell upon the sufferings of the unhappy prisoners. Many hundreds fell on the steppe, where their bodies would lie until winter, when the wolves would devour the remnants of their bones. As Nadia helped the old Siberian, so in the same way did Michael render to his more feeble companions in misfortune such services as his situation allowed. He encouraged some, supported others, going to and fro, until a prick from a soldier's lance obliged him to resume the place which had been assigned him in the ranks. Why did he not endeavor to escape? The reason was that he had now quite determined not to venture until the steppe was safe for him. He was resolved in his idea of going as far as Tomsk at the Emir's expense, and indeed he was right. As he observed the numerous detachments which scoured the plain on the convoy's flanks, now to the south, now to the north, it was evident that before he could have gone 2 versts he must have been recaptured. The Tartar horsemen swarmed. It actually appeared as if they sprang from the earth, like insects which a thunderstorm brings to the surface of the ground. Flight under these conditions would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible. The soldiers of the escort displayed excessive vigilance, for they would have paid for the slightest carelessness with their heads. At nightfall on the 15th of August, the convoy reached the little village of Zabedyero, 30 versts from Tomsk. The prisoners' first movement would have been to rush into the river, but they were not allowed to leave the ranks until the halt had been organized. although the current of the Tom was just now like a torrent, it might have favored the flight of some bold or desperate man, and the strictest measures of vigilance were taken. Boats, requisitioned at Zabediero, were brought up to the Tom and formed a line of obstacles impossible to pass. As to the encampment on the outskirts of the village, it was guarded by a cordon of sentinels. Michael Strogoff, who now naturally thought of escape, saw, after carefully surveying the situation, that under these conditions it was perfectly impossible, so, not wishing to compromise himself, he waited. The prisoners were to encamp for the whole night on the banks of the Tom, for the Emir had put off the entrance of his troops into Tomsk. It had been decided that a military fete should mark the inauguration of the Tartar headquarters in this important city. Feofar Khan had already occupied the fortress, but the bulk of his army bivouacked under its walls, waiting until the time came for them to make a solemn entry. Ivan Ogareff left the Emir at Tomsk, where both had arrived the evening before, and returned to the camp at Zabediero. From here he was to start the next day with the rear guard of the Tartar army. A house had been arranged for him in which to pass the night. At sunrise, horse and foot soldiers were to proceed to Tomsk, where the Emir wished to receive them with the pomp usual to Asiatic sovereigns. As soon as the halt was organized, the prisoners, worn out with their 3 days' journey and suffering from burning thirst, could drink and take a little rest. The sun had already set when Nadia, supporting Marfa Strogoff, reached the banks of the Tom. They had not till then been able to get through those who crowded the banks, but at last they came to drink in their turn. The old woman bent over the clear stream, and Nadia, plunging in her hand, carried it to Marfa's lips. Then she refreshed herself. They found new life in these welcome waters. Suddenly Nadia started up. An involuntary cry escaped her. Michael Strogoff was there, a few steps from her. It was he. The dying rays of the sun fell upon him. At Nadia's cry, Michael started, but he had sufficient command over himself not to utter a word by which he might have been compromised, and yet, when he saw Nadia, he also recognized his mother. Feeling he could not long keep master of himself at this unexpected meeting, he covered his eyes with his hands and walked quickly away. Nadia's impulse was to run after him, but the old Siberian murmured in her ear, "Stay, my daughter!" "It is he," replied Nadia, choking with emotion. "He lives, mother. It is he. It is my son," answered Marfa. "It is Michael Strogoff, and you see that I do not make a step towards him. Imitate me, my daughter." Michael had just experienced the most violent emotion which a man can feel. His mother and Nadia were there. The two prisoners who were always together in his heart, God had brought them together in this common misfortune. Did Nadia know who he was? Yes, for he had seen Marfa's gesture, holding her back as she was about to rush towards him. Marfa then had understood all and kept his secret. During that night, Michael was 20 times on the point of looking for and joining his mother, but he knew that he must resist the longing he felt to take her in his arms and once more press the hand of his young companion. The least imprudence might be fatal. He had, besides, sworn not to see his mother. Once at Tomsk, since he could not escape this very night, he would set off without having even embraced the two beings in whom all the happiness of his life was centered, and whom he should leave exposed to so many perils. Michael hoped that this fresh meeting at the Zabediero camp would have no disastrous consequences either to his mother or to himself. But he did not know that part of this scene, although it passed so rapidly, had been observed by Sangar, Ogareff's spy. The Tsigane was there, a few paces off, on the bank as usual, watching the old Siberian woman. She had not caught sight of Michael, for he disappeared before she had time to look around, but the mother's gesture as she kept back Nadia had not escaped her, and the look in Marfa's eyes told her all. It was now beyond doubt that Marfa Strogoff's son, the Tsar's courier, was at this moment in Zabediero, among Ivan Ogareff's prisoners. Sangar did not know him, but she knew that he was there. She did not then attempt to discover him, for it would have been impossible in the dark and the immense crowd. As for again watching Nadia and Marfa Strogoff, that was equally useless.
It was evident that the two women would keep on their guard, and it would be impossible to overhear anything of a nature to compromise the courier of the Tsar. The Tsigane's first thought was to tell Ivan Ogareff. She therefore immediately left the encampment. A quarter of an hour after, she reached Zabediero, and was shown into the house occupied by the Emir's lieutenant. Ogareff received the Tsigane directly.
"What have you to tell me, Sangar?"
he asked.
"Marfa Strogoff's son is in the encampment."
"A prisoner?"
"A prisoner."
"Ah," exclaimed Ogareff, "I shall know." "You will know nothing, Ivan," replied the Tsigane,
"for you do not even know him by sight."
"But you know him. You have seen him, Sangar?"
"I have not seen him, but his mother betrayed herself by a gesture, which told me everything."
"Are you not mistaken?"
"I am not mistaken."
"You know the importance which I attach to the apprehension of this courier," said Ivan Ogareff. "If the letter which he has brought from Moscow reaches Irkutsk, if it is given to the Grand Duke will be on his guard, and I shall not be able to get at him. I must have that letter at any price. Now you come to tell me that the bearer of this letter is in my power. I repeat, Sangar, are you not mistaken?"
Ogareff spoke with great animation. His emotion showed the extreme importance he attached to the possession of this letter. Sangar was not at all put out by the urgency with which Ogareff repeated his question.
"I am not mistaken, Ivan," she said.
"But, Sangar, there are thousands of prisoners, and you say that you do not know Michael Strogoff?"
"No," answered the Tsigane with a look of savage joy. "I do not know him, but his mother knows him. Ivan, we must make his mother speak."
"Tomorrow she shall speak," cried Ogareff.
So saying, he extended his hand to the Tsigane, who kissed it, for there is nothing servile in this act of respect, it being usual among the northern races. Sangar returned to the camp. She found out Nadia and Marfa Strogoff, and passed the night in watching them. Although worn out with fatigue, the old woman and the girl did not sleep. Their great anxiety kept them awake. Michael was living, but a prisoner. Did Ogareff know him, or would he not soon find him out? Nadia was occupied by the one thought that he whom she thought dead still lived. But Marfa saw further into the future, and although she did not care what became of herself, she had every reason to fear for her son. Sangar, under cover of the night, had crept near the two women, and remained there several hours listening. She heard nothing. From an instinctive feeling of prudence, not a word was exchanged between Nadia and Marfa Strogoff. The next day, the 16th of August, about 10 in the morning, trumpet calls resounded throughout the encampment. The Tartar soldiers were almost immediately under arms. Ivan Ogareff arrived, surrounded by a large staff of Tartar officers. His face was more clouded than usual, and his knitted brow gave signs of latent wrath which was waiting for an occasion to break forth. Michael Strogoff, hidden in a group of prisoners, saw this man pass. He had a presentiment that some catastrophe was imminent, for Ivan Ogareff knew now that Marfa was the mother of Michael Strogoff. Ogareff dismounted, and his escort cleared a large circle round him. Just then Sangar approached him and said, "I have no news." Ivan Ogareff's only reply was to give an order to one of his officers. Then the ranks of prisoners were brutally hurried up by the soldiers. The unfortunate people, driven on with whips or pushed on with lances, arranged themselves round the camp. A strong guard of soldiers drawn up behind rendered escape impossible. Silence then ensued, and on a sign from Ivan Ogareff, Sangar advanced towards the group, in the midst of which stood Marfa. The old Siberian saw her and knew what was going to happen. A scornful smile passed over her face. Then, leaning towards Nadia, she said in a low tone,
"You know me no longer, my daughter. Whatever may happen, and however hard this trial may be, not a word, not a sign. It concerns him and not me."
At that moment Sangar, having regarded her for an instant, put her hand on her shoulder.
"What do you want with me?" said Marfa.
"Come," replied Sangar, and pushing the old Siberian before her, she took her to Ivan Ogareff, in the middle of the cleared ground. Michael cast down his eyes that their angry flashings might not appear.
Marfa, standing before Ivan Ogareff, drew herself up, crossed her arms on her breast, and waited.
"You are Marfa Strogoff?" asked Ogareff.
"Yes,"
replied the old Siberian calmly. "Do you retract what you said to me when 3 days ago I interrogated you at Omsk?"
"No."
"Then you do not know that your son, Michael Strogoff, courier of the Tsar, has passed through Omsk?"
"I do not know it."
"And the man in whom you thought you recognized your son, was not he your son?"
"He was not my son."
"And since then you have not seen him amongst the prisoners?"
"No."
"If he were pointed out, would you recognize him?"
"No."
On this reply, which showed such determined resolution, a murmur was heard amongst the crowd. Ogareff could not restrain a threatening gesture.
"Listen," said he to Marfa, "your son is here, and you shall immediately point him out to me."
"No."
"All these men, taken at Omsk and Kolyvan, will defile before you. And if you do not show me Michael Strogoff, you shall receive as many blows of the knout as men shall have passed before you."
Ivan Ogareff saw that, whatever might be his threats, whatever might be the tortures to which he submitted her, the indomitable Siberian would not speak. To discover the courier of the Tsar, he counted then not on her, but on Michael himself. He did not believe it possible that, when mother and son were in each other's presence, some involuntary movement would not betray him. Of course, had he wished to seize the imperial letter, he would simply have given orders to search all the prisoners, but Michael might have destroyed the letter, having learnt its contents, and if he were not recognized, if he were to reach Irkutsk, all Ivan Ogareff's plans would be baffled. It was thus not only the letter which the traitor must have, but the bearer himself. Nadia had heard all, and she now knew who was Michael Strogoff, and why he had wished to cross, without being recognized, the invaded provinces of Siberia. On an order from Ivan Ogareff, the prisoners defiled, one by one, past Marfa, who remained immovable as a statue, and whose face expressed only perfect indifference. Her son was among the last. When, in his turn, he passed before his mother, Nadia shut her eyes that she might not see him. Michael was, to all appearance, unmoved, but the palm of his hand bled under his nails, which were pressed into them. Ivan Ogareff was baffled by mother and son. Sangar, close to him, said one word, "The knout!"
"Yes,"
cried Ogareff, who could no longer restrain himself, "the knout for this wretched old woman, the knout to the death!" A Tartar soldier bearing this terrible instrument of torture approached Marfa. The knout is composed of a certain number of leathern thongs, at the end of which are attached pieces of twisted iron wire. It is reckoned that a sentence to 120 blows of this whip is equivalent to a sentence of death. Marfa knew it, but she knew also that no torture would make her speak. She was sacrificing her life. Marfa, seized by two soldiers, was forced on her knees on the ground. Her dress, torn off, left her back bare. A saber was placed before her breast, at a few inches' distance only. Directly she bent beneath her suffering, her breast would be pierced by the sharp steel. The Tartar drew himself up. He waited.
"Begin!"
said Ogareff. The whip whistled in the air. But before it fell, a powerful hand stopped the Tartar's arm. Michael was there. He had leapt forward at this horrible scene. If at the relay at Ichim he had restrained himself when Ogareff's whip had struck him, here before his mother, who was about to be struck, he could not do so. Ivan Ogareff had succeeded.
"Michael Strogoff!"
cried he, then advancing.
"Ah, the man of Ichim!"
"Himself," said Michael, and raising the knout he struck Ogareff a sharp blow across the face.
"Blow for blow,"
said he.
"Well repaid,"
cried a voice concealed by the tumult. 20 soldiers threw themselves on Michael, and in another instant he would have been slain. But Ogareff, who on being struck had uttered a cry of rage and pain, stopped them.
"This man is reserved for the Emir's judgment,"
said he.
"Search him."
The letter with the imperial arms was found in Michael's bosom. He had not had time to destroy it. It was handed to Ogareff. The voice which had pronounced the words, "Well repaid," was that of no other than Alcide Jolivet.
"Pardieu," said he to Blount, "they are rough, these people. Acknowledge that we owe our travelling companion a good turn. Korpanoff or Strogoff is worthy of it.
Oh, that was fine retaliation for the little affair at Ishim.
Yes, retaliation, truly, replied Blount, but Strogoff is a dead man. I suspect that, for his own interest at all events, it would have been better had he not possessed quite so lively a recollection of the event.
And let his mother perish under the knout?
Do you think that either she or his sister will be a bit better off from this outbreak of his?
I do not know or think anything, except that I should have done much the same in his position, replied Alcide. What a scar the colonel has received! Bah! One must boil over sometimes.
We should have had water in our veins instead of blood had it been incumbent on us to be always and everywhere unmoved to wrath.
A neat little incident for our journals, observed Blount, if only Ivan Ogareff would let us know the contents of that letter.
Ivan Ogareff, when he had stanched the blood which was trickling down his face, had broken the seal. He read and reread the letter deliberately, as if he was determined to discover everything it contained. Then, having ordered that Michael, carefully bound and guarded, should be carried on to Tomsk with the other prisoners, he took command of the troops at Zabediero, and, amid the deafening noise of drums and trumpets, he marched towards the town where the Emir awaited him. End of Book 2, Chapter 3. Book 2, Chapter 4 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 4. The Triumphal Entry. Tomsk, founded in 1604, nearly in the heart of the Siberian provinces, is one of the most important towns in Asiatic Russia. Tobolsk, situated above the 60th parallel, Irkutsk, built beyond the 100th meridian, have seen Tomsk increase at their expense. And yet Tomsk, as has been said, is not the capital of this important province. It is at Omsk that the governor-general of the province and the official world reside. But Tomsk is the most considerable town of that territory. The country being rich, the town is so likewise, for it is in the center of fruitful mines. In the luxury of its houses, its arrangements, and its equipages, it might rival the greatest European capitals. It is a city of millionaires, enriched by the spade and pickaxe, and though it has not the honor of being the residence of the Tsar's representative, it can boast of including in the first rank of its notables the chief of the merchants of the town, the principal grantees of the imperial government's mines. But the millionaires were fled now, and except for the crouching poor, the town stood empty to the hordes of Feofar Khan. At 4 o'clock the Emir made his entry into the square, greeted by a flourish of trumpets, the rolling sound of the big drums, salvos of artillery and musketry. Feofar mounted his favorite horse, which carried on its head an aigrette of diamonds. The Emir still wore his uniform. He was accompanied by a numerous staff, and beside him walked the Khans of Kokand and Kondouj and the grand dignitaries of the Khanates. At the same moment appeared on the terrace the chief of Feofar's wives, the queen, if this title may be given to the Sultana of the States of Bokhara. But, queen or slave, this woman of Persian origin was wonderfully beautiful. Contrary to the Mohammedan custom, and no doubt by some caprice of the Emir, she had her face uncovered. Her hair, divided into four plaits, fell over her dazzling white shoulders, scarcely concealed by a veil of silk worked in gold, which fell from the back of a cap studded with gems of the highest value. Under her blue silk petticoat fell the zerjame of silken gauze, and above the sash lay the piran. But from the head to the little feet, such was the profusion of jewels, gold beads strung on silver threads, chaplets of turquoises, ferouzes from the celebrated mines of Elbourz, necklaces of cornelians, agates, emeralds, opals, and sapphires, that her dress seemed to be literally made of precious stones. The thousands of diamonds which sparkled on her neck, arms, hands, at her waist, and at her feet might have been valued at almost countless millions of rubles. The Emir and the Khans dismounted, as did the dignitaries who escorted them. All entered a magnificent tent erected on the center of the first terrace. Before the tent, as usual, the Koran was laid. Feofar's lieutenant did not make them wait, and before 5 o'clock the trumpets announced his arrival. Ivan Ogareff, the Scarred Cheek, as he was already nicknamed, wearing the uniform of a Tartar officer, dismounted before the Emir's tent. He was accompanied by a party of soldiers from the camp at Zabediero, which ranged up the sides of the square, in the middle of which a place for the sports was reserved. A large scar could be distinctly seen cut obliquely across the traitor's face. Ogareff presented his principal officers to the Emir, who, without departing from the coldness which composed the main part of his dignity, received them in a way which satisfied them that they stood well in the good graces of their chief. At least so thought Harry Blount and Alcide Jolivet, the two inseparables, now associated together in the chase after news. After leaving Zabediero, they had proceeded rapidly to Tomsk. The plan they had agreed upon was to leave the Tartars as soon as possible, and to join a Russian regiment, and, if they could, to go with them to Irkutsk. All that they had seen of the invasion, its burnings, its pillages, its murders, had perfectly sickened them, and they longed to be among the ranks of the Siberian army. Jolivet had told his companion that he could not leave Tomsk without making a sketch of the triumphal entry of the Tartar troops, if it was only to satisfy his cousin's curiosity, but the same evening they both intended to take the road to Irkutsk, and being well mounted, hoped to distance the Emir's scouts. Alcide and Blount mingled therefore in the crowd, so as to lose no detail of a festival which ought to supply them with 100 good lines for an article. They admired the magnificence of Feofar Khan, his wives, his officers, his guards, and all the eastern pomp, of which the ceremonies of Europe can give not the least idea. But they turned away with disgust when Ivan Ogareff presented himself before the Emir, and waited with some impatience for the amusements to begin.
"You see, my dear Blount," said Alcide, "we have come too soon, like honest citizens who like to get their money's worth. All this is before the curtain rises. It would have been better to arrive only for the ballet."
"What ballet?" asked Blount.
"The compulsory ballet, to be sure. But see, the curtain is going to rise."
Alcide Jolivet spoke as if he had been at the opera, and taking his glass from its case, he prepared, with the air of a connoisseur, to examine the first act of Feofar's company. A painful ceremony was to precede the sports. In fact, the triumph of the vanquisher could not be complete without the public humiliation of the vanquished. This was why several hundreds of prisoners were brought under the soldiers' whips. They were destined to march past Feofar Khan and his allies before being crammed with their companions into the prisons in the town. In the first ranks of these prisoners figured Michael Strogoff. As Ogareff had ordered, he was specially guarded by a file of soldiers. His mother and Nadia were there also. The old Siberian, although energetic enough when her own safety was in question, was frightfully pale. She expected some terrible scene. It was not without reason that her son had been brought before the Emir. She therefore trembled for him. Ivan Ogareff was not a man to forgive having been struck in public by the knout, and his vengeance would be merciless. Some frightful punishment familiar to the barbarians of Central Asia would, no doubt, be inflicted on Michael. Ogareff had protected him against the soldiers because he well knew what would happen by reserving him for the justice of the Emir. The mother and son had not been able to speak together since the terrible scene in the camp at Zabediero. They had been pitilessly kept apart. A bitter aggravation for their misery, for it would have been some consolation to have been together during these days of captivity. Marfa longed to ask her son's pardon for the harm she had unintentionally done him, for she reproached herself with not having commanded her maternal feelings. If she had restrained herself in that post-house at Omsk, when she found herself face to face with him, Michael would have passed unrecognized, and all these misfortunes would have been avoided. Michael, on his side, thought that if his mother was there, if Ogareff had brought her with him, it was to make her suffer with the sight of his own punishment, or perhaps some frightful death was reserved for her also.
As to Nadia, she only asked herself how she could save them both, how come to the aid of son and mother. And yet she could only wonder, but she felt instinctively that she must above everything avoid drawing attention upon herself, that she must conceal herself, make herself insignificant. Perhaps she might at least gnaw through the meshes which imprisoned the lion. At any rate, if any opportunity was given her, she would seize upon it and sacrifice herself, if need be, for the son of Marfa Strogoff. In the meantime, the greater part of the prisoners were passing before the Emir, and as they passed, each was obliged to prostrate himself, with his forehead in the dust, in token of servitude. Slavery begins by humiliation. When the unfortunate people were too slow in bending, the rough guards threw them violently to the ground. Alcide Jolivet and his companion could not witness such a sight without feeling indignant.
"It is cowardly. Let us go," said Alcide.
"No," answered Blount, "we must see it all."
"See it all? Ah!"
cried Alcide, suddenly grasping his companion's arm.
"What is the matter with you?" asked the latter. "Look, Blount, it is she."
"What she?"
"The sister of our traveling companion, alone and a prisoner. We must save her."
"Calm yourself," replied Blount coolly. "Any interference on our part in behalf of the young girl would be worse than useless." Alcide Jolivet, who had been about to rush forward, stopped, and Nadia, who had not perceived them, her features being half hidden by her hair, passed in her turn before the Emir without attracting his attention. However, after Nadia came Marfa Strogoff, and as she did not throw herself quickly in the dust, the guards brutally pushed her. She fell. Her son struggled so violently that the soldiers who were guarding him could scarcely hold him back. But the old woman rose, and they were about to drag her on, when Ogareff interposed, saying,
"Let that woman stay."
As to Nadia, she happily regained the crowd of prisoners. Ivan Ogareff had taken no notice of her. Michael was then led before the Emir, and there he remained standing, without casting down his eyes.
"Your forehead to the ground," cried Ogareff.
"No,"
answered Michael. Two soldiers endeavored to make him bend, but they were themselves laid on the ground by a buffet from the young man's fist. Ogareff approached Michael.
"You shall die," he said.
"I can die," answered Michael fiercely, "but your traitor's face, Ivan, will not the less carry forever the infamous brand of the knout."
At this reply, Ivan Ogareff became perfectly livid.
"Who is this prisoner?"
asked the Emir, in a tone of voice terrible from its very calmness.
"A Russian spy," answered Ogareff.
In asserting that Michael was a spy, he knew that the sentence pronounced against him would be terrible. The Emir made a sign at which all the crowd bent low their heads. Then he pointed with his hand to the Koran, which was brought him. He opened the sacred book and placed his finger on one of its pages. It was chance, or rather, according to the ideas of these Orientals, God himself, who was about to decide the fate of Michael Strogoff. The people of Central Asia give the name of Fal to this practice. After having interpreted the sense of the verse touched by the judge's finger, they apply the sentence, whatever it may be. The Emir had let his finger rest on the page of the Quran. The chief of the Ulemas then approached and read in a loud voice a verse which ended with these words,
"And he will no more see the things of this earth."
"Russian spy,"
exclaimed Feofar Khan in a voice trembling with fury,
"you have come to see what is going on in the Tartar camp. Then look while you may."
End of Book 2, Chapter 4. Book 2, Chapter 5 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 5. Look While You May. Michael was held before the Emir's throne, at the foot of the terrace, his hands bound behind his back. His mother, overcome at last by mental and physical torture, had sunk to the ground, daring neither to look nor listen.
"Look while you may," exclaimed Feofar Khan, stretching his arm towards Michael in a threatening manner.
Doubtless Ivan Ogareff, being well acquainted with Tartar customs, had taken in the full meaning of these words, for his lips curled for an instant in a cruel smile. He then took his place by Feofar Khan. A trumpet call was heard. This was the signal for the amusements to begin.
"Here comes the ballet," said Alcide to Blount. "But, contrary to our customs, these barbarians give it before the drama."
Michael had been commanded to look at everything. He looked. A troop of dancers poured into the open space before the Emir's tent. Different Tartar instruments, the dutari, a long-handled guitar, the kobize, a kind of violoncello, the chibizga, a long reed flute, wind instruments, tom-toms, tambourines, united with the deep voices of the singers, formed a strange harmony. Added to this were the strains of an aerial orchestra, composed of a dozen kites, which, fastened by strings to their centers, resounded in the breeze like Aeolian harps. Then the dancers began. The performers were all of Persian origin. They were no longer slaves, but exercised their profession at liberty. Formerly they figured officially in the ceremonies at the court of Tehran, but since the accession of the reigning family, banished or treated with contempt, they had been compelled to seek their fortune elsewhere. They wore the national costume, and were adorned with a profusion of jewels. Little triangles of gold, studded with jewels, glittered in their ears. Circles of silver, marked with black, surrounded their necks and legs. These performers gracefully executed various dances, sometimes alone, sometimes in groups. Their faces were uncovered, but from time to time they threw a light veil over their heads, and a gauze cloud passed over their bright eyes as smoke over a starry sky. Some of these Persians wore leathern belts embroidered with pearls, from which hung little triangular bags. From these bags, embroidered with golden filigree, they drew long narrow bands of scarlet silk, on which were braided verses of the Quran. These bands, which they held between them, formed a belt under which the other dancers darted, and as they passed each verse, following the precept it contained, they either prostrated themselves on the earth or lightly bounded upwards, as though to take a place among the houri of Mohammed's heaven. But what was remarkable, and what struck Alcide, was that the Persians appeared rather indolent than fiery. Their passion had deserted them, and by the kind of dances as well as by their execution, they recalled rather the calm and self-possessed nosh girls of India than the impassioned dancers of Egypt. When this was over, a stern voice was heard saying, "Look while you may." The man who repeated the Emir's words, a tall, spare Tartar, was he who carried out the sentences of Feofar Khan against offenders. He had taken his place behind Michael, holding in his hand a broad curved saber, one of those Damascene blades which are forged by the celebrated armors of Karshi or Hisar. Behind him guards were carrying a tripod supporting a chafing dish filled with live coals. No smoke arose from this, but a light vapor surrounded it, due to the incineration of a certain aromatic and resinous substance which he had thrown on the surface. The Persians were succeeded by another party of dancers, whom Michael recognized. The journalists also appeared to recognize them, for Blount said to his companion, "These are the Tsiganis of Nizhny Novgorod."
"No doubt of it," cried Alcide. "Their eyes, I imagine, bring more money to these spies than their legs."
In putting them down as agents in the Emir's service, Alcide Jolivet was, by all accounts, not mistaken. In the first rank of the Tsiganes, Sangar appeared, superb in her strange and picturesque costume, which set off still further her remarkable beauty. Sangar did not dance, but she stood as a statue in the midst of the performers, whose style of dancing was a combination of that of all those countries through which their race had passed, Turkey, Bohemia, Egypt, Italy, and Spain. They were enlivened by the sound of cymbals, which clashed on their arms, and by the hollow sound of the dares, a sort of tambourine played with the fingers. Sangar, holding one of these dares, which she played between her hands, encouraged this troop of veritable corybants. A young Tsigane, of about 15 years of age, then advanced. He held in his hand a dutari, strings of which he made to vibrate by a simple movement of the nails. He sung. During the singing of each couplet, of very peculiar rhythm, a dancer took her position by him and remained there immovable, listening to him, but each time that the burden came from the lips of the young singer, she resumed her dance, dinning in his ears with her dare, and deafening him with the clashing of her cymbals. Then, after the last chorus, the remainder surrounded the Tsigane in the windings of their dance. At that moment a shower of gold fell from the hands of the emir and his train, and from the hands of his officers of all ranks, to the noise which the pieces made as they struck the cymbals of the dancers, being added the last murmurs of the Dutaris and tambourines.
"Lavish as robbers," said Alcide in the ear of his companion,
and in fact it was the result of plunder which was falling, for, with the Tartar tomans and sequins, reigned also Russian ducats and rubles. Then silence followed for an instant, and the voice of the executioner, who laid his hand on Michael's shoulder, once more pronounced the words, which this repetition rendered more and more sinister,
"Look while you may."
But this time Alcide observed that the executioner no longer held the saber bare in his hand. Meanwhile, the sun had sunk behind the horizon. A semi-obscurity began to envelop the plain. The mass of cedars and pines became blacker and blacker, and the waters of the Tom, totally obscured in the distance, mingled with the approaching shadows. But at that instant several hundreds of slaves, bearing lighted torches, entered the square. Led by Sangar, Tsiganes and Persians reappeared before the emir's throne, and showed off, by the contrast, their dances of styles so different. The instruments of the Tartar orchestra sounded forth in harmony still more savage, accompanied by the guttural cries of the singers. The kites, which had fallen to the ground, once more winged their way into the sky, each bearing a parti-colored lantern, and under a fresher breeze their harps vibrated with intenser sound in the midst of the aerial illumination. Then a squadron of Tartars, in their brilliant uniforms, mingled in the dances, whose wild fury was increasing rapidly, and then began a performance which produced a very strange effect. Soldiers came on the ground, armed with bare sabers and long pistols, and as they executed dances, they made the air re-echo with the sudden detonations of their firearms, which immediately set going the rumbling of the tambourines, and grumblings of the dares, and the gnashing of Dutaris. Their arms, covered with a colored powder of some metallic ingredient, after the Chinese fashion, threw long jets, red, green, and blue, so that the groups of dancers seemed to be in the midst of fireworks. In some respects, this performance recalled the military dance of the ancients, in the midst of naked swords, but this Tartar dance was rendered yet more fantastic by the colored fire, which wound serpent-like above the dancers, whose dresses seemed to be embroidered with fiery hems. It was like a kaleidoscope of sparks, whose infinite combinations varied at each moment of the dancers. Though it may be thought that a Parisian reporter would be perfectly hardened to any scenic effect, which our modern ideas have carried so far, yet Alcide Jolivet could not restrain a slight movement of the head, which at home, between the Boulevard Montmartre and La Madeleine, would have said, "Very fair, very fair." Then suddenly, at a signal, all the lights of the fantasia were extinguished, the dances ceased, and the performers disappeared. The ceremony was over, and the torches alone lighted up the plateau, which a few instants before had been so brilliantly illuminated. On a sign from the emir, Michael was led into the middle of the square.
"Blount," said Alcide to his companion, "are you going to see the end of all this?"
"No, that I am not," replied Blount.
"The readers of the Daily Telegraph are, I hope, not very eager for the details of an execution à la mode Tatar.
No more than your cousin."
"Poor fellow," added Alcide as he watched Michael, "that valiant soldier should have fallen on the field of battle."
"Can we do nothing to save him?" said Blount.
"Nothing."
The reporters recalled Michael's generous conduct towards them. They knew now through what trials he must have passed, ever obedient to his duty, and in the midst of these Tartars, to whom pity is unknown, they could do nothing for him. Having little desire to be present at the torture reserved for the unfortunate man, they returned to the town. An hour later, they were on the road to Irkutsk,
for it was among the Russians that they intended to follow what Alcide called, by anticipation, the campaign of revenge. Meantime, Michael was standing ready, his eyes returning the Emir's haughty glance, while his countenance assumed an expression of intense scorn whenever he cast his looks on Ivan Ogareff. He was prepared to die, yet not a single sign of weakness escaped him. The spectators waiting around the square, as well as Feofar Khan's bodyguard, to whom this execution was only one of the attractions, were eagerly expecting it. Then, their curiosity satisfied, they would rush off to enjoy the pleasures of intoxication. The Emir made a sign. Michael was thrust forward by his guards to the foot of the terrace, and Feofar said to him, "You came to see our goings-out and comings-in, Russian spy. You have seen for the last time. In an instant your eyes will be forever shut to the day." Michael's fate was to be not death, but blindness, loss of sight, more terrible perhaps than loss of life. The unhappy man was condemned to be blinded. However, on hearing the Emir's sentence, Michael's heart did not grow faint. He remained unmoved, his eyes wide open, as though he wished to concentrate his whole life into one last look. To entreat pity from these savage men would be useless. Besides, it would be unworthy of him. He did not even think of it. His thoughts were condensed on his mission, which had apparently so completely failed, on his mother, on Nadia, whom he should never more see. But he let no sign appear of the emotion he felt. Then a feeling of vengeance to be accomplished came over him. "Ivan," said he in a stern voice, "Ivan the traitor, the last menace of my eyes shall be for you." Ivan Ogareff shrugged his shoulders. But Michael was not to be looking at Ivan when his eyes were put out. Marfa Strogoff stood before him. "My mother," cried he, "yes, yes, my last glance shall be for you, and not for this wretch. Stay there before me. Now I see once more your well-beloved face. Now shall my eyes close as they rest upon it." The old woman, without uttering a word, advanced.
"Take that woman away,"
said Ivan. Two soldiers were about to seize her, but she stepped back and remained standing a few paces from Michael. The executioner appeared. This time he held his saber bare in his hand, and this saber he had just drawn from the chafing dish, where he had brought it to a white heat. Michael was going to be blinded in the Tartar fashion, with a hot blade passed before his eyes. Michael did not attempt to resist. Nothing existed before his eyes but his mother, whom his eyes seemed to devour. All his life was in that last look. Marfa Strogoff, her eyes open wide, her arms extended towards where he stood, was gazing at him. The incandescent blade passed before Michael's eyes. A despairing cry was heard. His aged mother fell senseless to the ground. Michael Strogoff was blind. His orders executed, the Emir retired with his train. There remained in the square only Ivan Ogareff and the torchbearers. Did the wretch intend to insult his victim yet further, and yet to give him a parting blow? Ivan Ogareff slowly approached Michael, who, feeling him coming, drew himself up. Ivan drew from his pocket the imperial letter, he opened it, and with supreme irony he held it up before the sightless eyes of the Tsar's courier, saying, "Read now, Michael Strogoff, read, and go up and repeat at Irkutsk what you have read. The true courier of the Tsar is Ivan Ogareff." This said, the traitor thrust the letter into his breast. Then, without looking round, he left the square, followed by the torchbearers. Michael was left alone, at a few paces from his mother, lying lifeless, perhaps dead. He heard in the distance cries and songs, the varied noises of a wild debauch. Tomsk, illuminated, glittered and gleamed. Michael listened. The square was silent and deserted. He went, groping his way, towards the place where his mother had fallen. He found her with his hand. He bent over her. He put his face close to hers. He listened for the beating of her heart. Then he murmured a few words. Did Marfa still live, and did she hear her son's words? Whether she did so or not, she made not the slightest movement. Michael kissed her forehead and her white locks.
Then he raised himself, and, groping with his foot, trying to stretch out his hand to guide himself, he walked by degrees to the edge of the square. Suddenly Nadia appeared. She walked straight to her companion. A knife in her hand cut the cords which bound Michael's arms. The blind man knew not who had freed him, for Nadia had not spoken a word. But this done,
"Brother," said she.
"Nadia," murmured Michael. "Nadia!"
"Come, brother," replied Nadia. "Use my eyes whilst yours sleep. I will lead you to Irkutsk."
End of Book 2, Chapter 5.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.